The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
This week on Retronauts, we're serving word burgers. G'day everybody, welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mickey, and today we're going to be talking about Mad Max, the five film series we've never discussed on this fine little podcast. And before I go on any further, before me accent slips, I might be Cockney at this point, I want to introduce who's on the line here today, and then I can drop this entirely in our Australian contingent can stop unsubscribing en masse. I think it's happening now, and okay, whew. I got through it. Okay. Who is joining us from Japan, who's losing their minds currently?
Good morning, everyone. And as I've said many times on the record, please do not refer to me as my birth name. That was between me and my parents. I am no longer Sprague. My name is Diamond Fight.
Thank you. And yes, we all learned that Sprague means child. It feels insulting. We'll talk more about that soon. Who else do we have on the line today to talk about Mad Max?
Hello, I'm Stuart Chip, and you may have heard of Ezrock. Well, I am preceding Ezrock. That's the best
nice.
I could do.
There's room for all kinds of bodies and hairstyles in the Mad Max world. You know, I really wanted to sustain that Australian accent, but I couldn't do it for more than about 20 seconds. It's really hard because I tend to drift into New Zealand, and then I turn into a British person, and then it all goes downhill. Now, maybe Stuart can judge my British accent. That's not very good either.
Who am I to judge? I mean, just do as you please, and the plaudits will follow.
I mean, vowels are shifting everywhere. It's a crazy upside-down land named Australia. And I hope today that we can pin down why this is such a monumental pop culture property, and also figure out why there have only been two Mad Max games in the past 45 years. That surprised me. I assumed, oh, there's got to be, like, 10 Amiga games and a bunch of other little things I never noticed. But no, there's only two official Mad Max games. So yeah, this podcast, talk about the five movies, we'll talk about the couple games, and hopefully get all of you out there mid-mix peeled, because I assume we're all fans of this property, having been on the podcast.
That was
and
the worst.
Maybe I'll stop being Australian at this point. Let's see how this goes.
That was like
before
South
I go
Africa.
On any further. Oh, yeah, I could be drifting into South Africa. I'm all over the map. I'm a globetrotter with this accent. So I think that was a problem on the Simpsons Australia episode. I think they were also hitting the South African accent a lot there, too.
It's one of several problems, yeah.
Yes. Other than that, completely legit. All the facts check out. Before I go any further, though, I want to know where we all are sitting with the Mad Max franchise, where how we've experienced it, what our take is. Let's start with Diamond.
I suspect my history is similar to that of a lot of kids who grew up in the 80s, in that Mad Max was just kind of hanging over everything, even though they were very much movies for adults, so I did not watch them. But it's like, you couldn't get away from Mad Max riffs, Mad Max parodies. Like, I'm going to look it up, but I guarantee that Muppet Babies did at least one Mad Max joke. They must have on Muppet Babies. You know what I mean? So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I assume Kermit was Blaster, and Robin was Master.
Yeah, it's like, it almost certainly happened. So I grew up on this stuff just sort of in the background, like, I don't know what this is, but it seems pretty intense, you know, for me as a kid. And I don't think I actually got around to watching them until I was, you know, well into my 20s when I started renting them. And, you know, as we'll talk about each movie, I think each movie kind of hit me in a very different way. And then, you know, when Fury Road came out, I don't know if you know this, but a lot of movies come to Japan pretty late. So Fury Road opened in the West, and all my friends kind of went crazy about it. Like, Fury Road, it's the best movie I've ever seen. And I'm like, wait, it can't be. It can't be. And then it opened here, like, a few months later, and I watched it. And I remember turning to my friend, like, midway through, like, the first sequence of the car chase. And I'm like, I've never seen a movie like this in my life. And we just sort of kept going with that same energy. So I think since Fury Road, I've probably gone back and rewatched most of the movies at least once. And it's pretty impressive how all this stuff fits together and how it doesn't feel like anything else, even though decades of work have been sort of drawing from these pictures and these stories and these characters. You still watch, you know, you go and see Furiosa. Nothing really quite looks like Furiosa except for other Mad Max movies. Like, no one really gets it. So that to me is amazing. You know, I feel like, you know, we've talked a lot about on this podcast, the things that have a lot of influences. You know, we did Night of Living Dead. You know, we did Dune. We talked a lot of stuff that's had a big legacy. But Mad Max is weird that, like, no one really gets it right except for George Miller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of Mad Max ripoffs out there, too, in terms of movies that are aspiring to be it. Stuart, how about you and Mad Max?
I wasn't particularly interested in Mad Max for the vast majority of my existence. I don't know why. It just kind of passed over me. I think I heard that Tina Turner song, We Don't Need Another Hero. And I said, that's a pretty good song. I don't know what a Thunderdome is, but, you know, she's cool, you know. But then I saw the trailer for Fury Road, and I was just like, well, obviously I'm going to go and see this, because it was one of the best cut trailers of all time, I would say. Fury Road sort of blew my socks off. But for whatever reason, I didn't really revisit it, because I figured on the smaller screen, it's really not going to have the same level of impact that it does on the biggest possible screen. But then, not that long ago, actually, I think just a couple of weeks, I did revisit it, and I was like, oh no, that's just as good. That was absolutely amazing, if not better. I'm going to watch the other Mad Max movies. So I kind of sped through them all in about 3 days. Then I went to see Furiosa, and now I'm here with it all relatively fresh in my mind, which is nice.
Yeah, as for me, like you, Diamond, I grew up in the 80s. You're a tiny bit older than me, but there's some overlap there. And just, I understood what Mad Max was, but I was so inundated with everything that was inspired by it. And for the longest time, my mindset was, well, it's been referenced so much that the original can't have the same appeal. And I'm slowly getting over that. I'm slowly watching more movies that have been referenced too much, and finding out, yes, they're great, and they outlive the references. They're greater than the references. So, weirdly enough, before this podcast, I'd only seen the first Mad Max movie and Fury Road, because I was renting a lot of stuff from Netflix. I get the first Mad Max movie in the mail. I watch it, and I thought, oh, this is Mad Max? This is not what I was expecting at all, and there's more of these? That's so weird. Anyway, I'll just forget about this. And then Fury Road comes out 5 years later, and I'm just surprised. Oh, they're bringing this back? They must be desperate or something. And then, kind of like you, Diamond, a friend tells me, oh, you have to see this. It's a big deal. And then I go see it. And like you, Stuart, I'm blown away. It's an incredible experience, to the point where I don't want to watch it again. I feel I can't have the same experience. It won't have the same effect. It was such a special, magical time in the movies that I will tarnish it if I watch the movie again. But yes, it turns out, like Stuart, you can watch it on TV and it's good. It's still good.
It rolls,
and
yeah.
So for this podcast, I've watched them all, including Fury Road and Furiosa. And yeah, I watched Fury Road for the second time in 9 years, and I feel very stupid. I could have been watching this annually for a decade. My life could have been improved.
Anyway.
And yeah. Oh, go ahead, Stuart.
Weekly. Daily.
Weekly.
Wake up with
Fury. It could have been like every day on the elliptical machine, just pounding my way through the movie, aspiring to be as buff as a Morton Joe or something. Whoever the buffest character in that movie is.
Probably Rictus, right? That big
Rictus.
Dude with the weird stuff on his face. Yeah,
I'm working on a Rictus body right now. We'll see what happens. But yeah, I didn't play the 2015 game because I assumed it was trash. I didn't play the NES game because I didn't really know what it was, and the cover made it look boring. So honestly, most of the Mad Max stuff is new to me, and I'm, you know, seeing them for the first time for the most part, and I'm really getting a deeper appreciation for George Miller. In fact, he didn't direct the movie. He had a big hand in it. I watched Babe last night, and I thought it was delightful, and I have not seen that movie in 30 years. So I'm personally having a real George Miller renaissance in my condo here. So speaking of George Miller, we must talk about the man himself, the man behind Mad Max. So yes, this comes from the brain of director George Miller. He's an Australian guy who would later direct two CGI movies about horny penguins. That's how versatile he is. Yes, he created the Mad Max series, but then he creates the Babe series, and then he's behind Happy Feet. He wins an Oscar for Happy Feet. He's doing it all, folks. George Miller.
I keep hearing stories that he was going to do a Justice League movie, and I, you know, It's pointless to speculate about what could have happened, but boy, it sounds like that might have been a lot better than the Justice League movie we got.
Yeah, you know, that is true, but it does kind of stink sometimes to see promising directors attached to the Marvel handcuffs, basically.
And, yeah, yeah.
Kind of, I mean, it normally happens to younger people before they can actually make anything truly great, but maybe it would have been one and done with him. Maybe it would have been good, but that's just another what if for George Miller in his very, very long career.
A lot of ifs for him, actually. It's kind of amazing, considering how much he's made and how much has been success. There's still like a dozen, like, oh, what if he had done this? What if he had done this?
Yeah, there are so many potential Miller projects. And Fury Road kept being a potential project until he actually made it. And his origins are very interesting to the point where they sound made up. Because he was an emergency room doctor. And before he reached full doctor status, he pursued an interest in filmmaking. So he met with collaborator Byron Kennedy at a film workshop in Melbourne in 1971 at Melbourne University. And basically, Mad Max comes from him witnessing firsthand the violence that cars are capable of, what they can do to the human body, how, frankly, none of us should be driving around in them or walking anywhere near their path. As a pedestrian, I agree.
As a car, I'm torn.
I don't know what the laws were in Australia in the 70s, but I'm guessing if it was anything like the U.S., like, seatbelts were kind of like a suggestion for people. And certainly when you watch these movies, like, almost no one has ever belted in at all. So I can only imagine the horrors that he would have seen as, you know, people go out on a Friday night in, you know, in Sydney or whatever, and just, like, they're running into anything, and, like, you know, no one's belted. They've all got glass in their nose. Like, it's just nightmare after nightmare.
Yeah, this is around the time when the speed limit is being reeled back in America from 75 on the highway to 55 in a lot of places. So maybe things are more out of control in Australia. Maybe it's, you know, whatever the equivalent is, 1,000 kilometers an hour. I don't know. I was not raised to learn that kind of math. Only the wrong kind of math that applies in one country. So, yeah, he teams up with Byron Kennedy after meeting in this film workshop. He's still, you know, pursuing being a doctor. He eventually does his residency and becomes a full doctor, however that works. And he and Byron work on a lot of short films in their downtime. They start something called Kennedy Miller Productions in 1972. I'm not sure how much of their early work is available, but one of their shorts, which is called Violence in the Cinema Part 1 from 1971, this makes a lot of waves and won them some awards. So there's a little buzz happening around this little indie studio. And this could be on one of the Mad Max special editions, a Blu-ray, a Steelbook, a 4K. But I was only able to find a summary of this short. Essentially, it's a cheeky black comic short in which a professor is giving a lecture on the effects of violence in movies on filmgoers. 3 minutes into the speech, someone comes in and shoots him in the head. And he resumes the rest of his speech holding his bloody head together while committing acts of violence around him. So it's very silly, very dark. It feels almost like a Sam Raimi kind of thing with all the gore effects and things like that. But yeah, that is basically where he starts.
I really wanted to watch this, so I went looking for it in all of the sort of dark corners of the internet where you would normally find anything that you want to see. And apparently the only way to see this is to go and see it in some museum or something. It's not available publicly at all. I think you can only see it through like an academic, if you request to see it or something. Which I might end up doing at some point because I'm very curious.
Yeah, I could only find stills of it online. So I'm sure given the experience that Miller and Byron had and given the amount of money that they had, I don't know if it seems like it would look like a snuff film. It probably looks like a cheesy old science fiction movie in terms of the effects and everything in it.
If I had to guess, I would say that with him, probably it's fair to say he is either made his final film or is about to make his final film. He's I don't remember how old he is. It's like eight. I don't remember. It's a lot. But I would say this will probably show up at some point. If it ever does, it will be soon, I would say. So hopefully we'll be able to watch someone holding their head together soon.
I hope so. And, you know, I wouldn't count him out too early, Stuart, because Clint Eastwood is still making movies.
Oh, yeah,
90,
that's true. And they're all so good.
In his 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
Making much worse movies, still okay movies compared to George Miller. And then when I see George Miller in recent videos, you know, promoting Furiosa, talking with Hideo Kojima, I'm like, this is a spry-looking 81-year-old. He's tap dancing, he's scatting, he could be president.
That's a happy feat for you.
If I could elect one 81-year-old president, it would be George Miller. Unfortunately, that's illegal in America. I don't like that. So, yeah, he's making his name for himself in independent filmmaking. And it seems like it took him quite a while to scrape together the resources for his first feature because he's only credited on a few shorts between Violence in the Cinema, Part 1, and Mad Max, which debuted 8 years later in 1979. And it should be noted that he was also a doctor during this time period. So he had a very full plate. He had to, you know, save people's lives. And then in what time he had on the side, try to create a feature film. And apparently he was doing extra medical work on the side to fund this, getting government funding from local investors and things like that. It all took a very long time to come together and form the roots of the Mad Max franchise.
I mean, I feel like if you look at the filmmakers of that era who don't already have backing of a major studio, that tends to be the story, right? They have ideas, they have experiments, and unless you get an in, unless someone already hires you, your only option is just keep doing what you're doing. If you have a job, great. If you don't, just start borrowing, and then, you know, 5, 6, 7 years later, you'll get a movie. You know, I feel like Sam Raimi basically did that with him and his friends. Kevin Smith, of course, many years later, but Kevin Smith was like, you know, he just borrowed everything he could borrow and it took years to make, and then he made a movie. And it's like, I don't know. I wonder if it's easier or harder today in the fact that everyone has access to cameras, but also it's even harder to get the money together that you would actually need to make one of these things. And you kind of have to be famous to get a studio interested in your project. So I don't know. I feel like it's both typical of the era, and I wonder if it's even possible to do that today as far as like build your own career filmmakers. I don't know.
I guess because it's so potentially easy to film something and edit it together, people may now devalue that and say, well, anyone can make a movie. Why can't I just make AI do it or just hire anyone to do it?
Yeah.
Now, but back in his day, you needed to learn how film worked, how lighting worked. All the very, physical properties of filmmaking that aren't as apparent today, aren't as necessary today. Stuart?
Oh, no, I was just going to say something similar, really. But, of course, there are a lot of sort of films or short films or concepts that get made that go viral. I'm going to say Backrooms as an example, that then, of course, get picked up by sort of other filmmakers who say, hey, we want to sort of extrapolate this. We want to capitalize on this. So I guess it's easier to get your work out there where it could be seen, whereas obviously at this time there's so much more to consider to even be able to go, here's a piece of film with something I made on it or we made on it. It's just not going to happen unless you put the work in.
Yeah, and even for his time, Miller didn't take a traditional route in terms of becoming a filmmaker, where if you look at people from his generation like George Lucas and Steven Spielberg and Francis Ford Coppola, and I think even Scorsese, they are all film school graduates. There were now these things called film schools you can go to. And then they studied film and they fell in with collaborators and they would go on to, you know, maybe direct a few commercials, maybe direct an episode of Columbo and then impress people enough to make their own features and go from there. Miller and Byron Kennedy completely self-taught and learned on the job and also learned via just studying movies. They weren't hired by professional productions to learn as they went. They learned by making their own things. And it's stunning that they were able to stay afloat. I guess it just speaks to their natural talent that the original Mad Max, while very scrappy, is so profound in terms of just a nice piece of guerrilla filmmaking.
I feel like a lot of movies in the 70s, especially, you know, I think we talk about the what went into Mad Max and made it happen. I think there's a lot of movies from the 70s that just have, like, you know, cars. Like, it's the cars are the star, almost. You know, like, this. I'm thinking of Gone in 60 Seconds. I'm thinking of, like, Vanishing Point. Just these, I don't want to be over reductive. Like, those movies have stories and characters in them. But it's like, the cars are almost the centerpiece. The cars are what get people in the studio. It's like, hey, we're gonna get a lot of cars on the screen, and we're going to be driving all over the place. Come check this out, you guys. And I feel like it's almost amazing that he was able to get this done with all these, you know, literal moving parts. You know, he had think about all the people you have to get on board for this movie to drive around. You got to find open areas. You got to be driving around all the time. You have to have these people who are willing to take huge risks. Like every single car crash in the first movie, especially, looks like it should be like a headline news. Just like every single one.
Maybe,
of them.
Yeah.
Even the ones that people just get up from. People get up from. It's like, ah, oh, I'll be fine. I'll be fine. Like, you're not fine. How are you fine?
Yeah, it's so dangerous, and there's so much impact because of it. You can tell that this is just cars smashing against one another. I guess he was like saying, "Look, don't worry, I'm a doctor. I'll just fix you up if you get like horribly, maimed." But it's amazing that nobody died. Like, it seems so dangerous, this film.
I was going to say the same thing, Stuart. I know people were injured, and I'm sure he was as careful as possible. But a lot of these shots, because I assume so many of the shots in the first movie are stolen shots. They didn't get permission to film anywhere. They had to do it then or not do it at all. Like, we only have one chance to do the stunt. And also, once we crash the car has been crashed. We won't have that car again. So make sure you do it right.
He knows that you to have more verisimilitude in the film, you need people actually doing these things. I mean, that carries all the way through to Fury Road, which has loads of practical stunts. Obviously, CGI sort of augmented and much safer and under a much more probably tight sort of studio health safety boundary. But in this movie, when you see someone like jump onto the front of a car, they're actually jumping onto the front of a car that is moving at full speed. And it's really kind of intense to watch still.
And before we move on to the movies, I do want to talk about the underlying concepts that inform basically the entire series. And the roots of the first movie come from a real life occurrence, which was the 1973 gas crisis in Australia. Worldwide, there just was a gas crisis, and it's very long and boring. I won't go into it here. Just know that gas was very, very expensive, and people were dealing with that fact for the first time in their life. They weren't used to a world in which gas could cost that much. The economy was not attuned to that. And in this gas crisis, Miller saw the violence people were willing to do to each other when resources suddenly became scarce. So that got the wheels turning in his head. Another idea that got the wheels turning in his head was, what if I did a silent movie with sound? And, you know, other Mad Max movies use dialogue to varying degrees, but more than any other filmmaker, more than any other film series, Mad Max tells through showing, I feel. And then that will fully pay off in Fury Road, which is nearly a nonstop chase for 2 hours. But the roots of that kind of basic concept are here in the first Mad Max film.
It's sort of to George's, it speaks to the talent, really, that in a first feature, I mean, yeah, there have been some shorts, but a feature is a totally different sort of altogether. It's got so much flair already. It's got so much directorial skill, and he clearly knows what he's doing. He knows where to point the camera. He knows how to do everything, really. And you get the impression he must have been watching one hell of a lot of movies before he got into this, because it's one of the most confident first features I can think of in terms of, I mean, it is kind of scrappy, but it's also amazing how unscrappy it actually is, considering everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And the third concept I wanted to roll back to, informing everything, is the idea of the Mad Max stories as folk tales. I mean, that does not really apply to the first movie because that's where it begins, and that it's more of a modern setting. But as the movies roll on, we see the character is sort of like Link in The Legend of Zelda. He's just a very mythic figure, and the timelines don't really line up in the way they should, and there's not a lot of continuity between movies, except for the last two, of course. But it's building upon that, you know, Wasteland Warrior character that could potentially spin off into so many different stories, but they've been very economical, and so far there have been five.
You know what I think about is the way the very first movie opens with the title card. It's just, it just says a few years from now, and I feel like that's probably taking a little bit from Star Wars as far as like a long time ago. And like it's just a little nugget to say, hey, I know this looks like the world you know, but it's not really where we live. It's kind of, you know, just use your imagination a little bit. And I feel like each movie kind of gets farther and farther from, you know, our reality. And then you have like the storyteller aspect sort of leaning into it. But even this movie that doesn't really have a narrator per se, it does have that opening title card that I feel like sort of sets the audience up. It's like, hey, we're just, it's a story, right? We're just telling a story here. You know, don't worry. You'll be safe if you drive home today. You'll be okay.
Yeah, it does. It feels a bit like maybe a cheeky riff on Star Wars, which was obviously very popular in 1979 when the film came out. And also maybe a sly wink to let you know we can't afford to depict the post-apocalypse. That's pretty expensive. Wait till the next movie. We can film in the desert then and build little settlements and stuff. And this one, it's just going to be you at home thinking, is Australia okay? What's going on in Australia? If you understand Mad Max in the way that we all understand it, the first movie can be very confusing. So let's talk about it. 1979, the first Mad Max. It takes place, like you said, Diamond, a few years from now. Now meaning whenever they filmed it. And it depicts this near post-apocalypse where things are at their tipping point. Society is largely functional, but, you know, roving gangs are now a problem. And, you know, there are certain things that don't exist in other Mad Max films. Like, hey, you can live in a nice house with your wife and go on vacation, but don't leave her alone because bad things might happen. So still, there are still things in society that are functioning in a way that aren't functioning in the more dire future movies. So don't if you go into the first Mad Max like I did thinking, well, this is what people are watching. What's going on here? Know that it becomes the thing you know a little bit later, but then there are so many elements in here that are later in the thing, you know.
Yeah, the world of First Mad Max, like the government exists. Obviously, you know, most of the lead characters are, you know, police officers in a sense, even though, you know, the way they act and the way they behave is kind of, you know, not in line with any police officers that we can think of. But like there's money, there's electricity, people have houses, even though you can see, you know, there clearly a lot of people have taken it upon themselves to drive around the country in, you know, exceedingly, you know, custom vehicles. I think about, you know, characters like, you don't even have lines. Like there's a scene where Max and Goose are just talking to a couple and it's like they have their own little like motorcycle and sidecar, and it's like a lady in like a bubble in the sidecar, and it's like these people have no lines whatsoever and they just drive away, and they're like, who are these people driving around Australia in like a sidecar with a bubble? Like are they roaming free? Are they going back to the home? Like, did they build that motorcycle themselves? Like, a lot of the, like, one-off characters in this movie, you really want to know where the hell they're going and where they came from. But, you know, you don't get that, and I feel like it only helps the movie in that, like, all the little people in the picture in the background seem like they're coming from somewhere and they're going to go somewhere else. It really gives everything a lived-in feel. Like, all these people are real. You're getting a glimpse of their lives, and then they're going to go back, you know, unless they die.
Yeah, that's true of this film. And then with the later films, when they can afford to dress the characters up in more elaborate and cartoonish ways, you're even more intrigued. Like, ooh, who's this person? And then later at the end, when you see the credits, you're like, oh, that was their name? And then the next time you watch it, you kind of keep an eye on what they're doing, because there's so many wild characters. And you have to know that George Miller probably has a story Bible where he's written out their entire biography and, you know, where they came from and how they feel about other characters in the world and things like that. But, you know, more than the other Mad Max films, this does feel like a product of the decade it came out in. Because if you watch a lot of movies from the 70s, like you were saying, Diamond, I think car chases are a big thing in movies from that era. We have like Smokey and the Bandit and Gone in 60 Seconds and Vanishing Point. On TV, we have things like the Dukes of Hazzard, where the most popular character in that show is the car. I mean, there's the Duke boys, but you're tuning in to see the car and it's lovely flag on the roof. But yeah, we're way into car chases. They're just in so many movies. And then like in a lot of 70s movies, this is also kind of a grimy revenge film. Although I will say that unlike a lot of those movies, this one is not fixated on sexual assault, which is why I think it's more palatable to go back to this. With a lot of those 70s movies, you have to know what you're getting into and know the ugliness they want to depict. Here, it's mostly violence.
The sexual stuff is certainly implied, but it's not really, it's not really shown. And the people, it's actually, the movie gets a lot of mileage, I think, pun intended, out of just people reacting to stuff without actually seeing it. You know, like I'm thinking about how when Max goes to see Goose in the hospital, you never see Goose. You just see what Max, you just see Max look at Goose and you see Max's face. I feel like the movie gets a, get, you know, does that to its advantage. You have a lot of people just react to stuff that they don't actually show. So, you know, like even the big moment where, you know, Max's wife and child die, like you just see like the, you know, the stereotypical, like the shoe on the highway kind of thing. You don't actually see what happens.
I mean, it's a nice budget-saving technique, but you're not lingering on the death of a child. Someone is just throwing a shoe off of their motorcycle as they're peeling off, and it says all it needs to say. Stuart?
Well, it's an interesting... It's almost... I don't know if I call it a subversion of the revenge sort of flick, but the actual inciting incident doesn't take place for a lot of this movie. I'd say maybe like even like two-thirds of this movie, Max is honestly miffed at best and doesn't really become mad until... You know, the obvious. I think that sequence with the shoe is really quite shocking, considering I know you don't see much, but the suddenness of it and almost the kind of like, yeah, that's just happened. There's no real sort of crescendo. It's just like they're there 1 second and then although those two characters are just gone. It's kind of interesting in that respect. The stuff with sort of sexual violence, unfortunately, does kind of crop up in The Road Warrior, which we'll obviously get to in a more sort of lurid manner. But yeah, here it is quite reserved in a sort of pleasing way. I really like this one a lot. This is like one of my favorites, I think. And I think the fact that it is quite pared back is one of the reasons why. I found it very sort of, you know, well-directed. It's quite well-paced. There's no, it doesn't really sag like some of the other movies do. It's all just a... enjoyable, relatively straightforward, with a quite sort of satisfying, if ultimately quite bleak, sort of finale. I had a good time watching this one.
Yeah, Stuart, I wanted to play off what you just said. I think when you go on Letterboxd, which, you know, we all do probably too much, and you see people react, especially to Mad Max, like, almost all the top comments are very muted, and some are like, you know, like Bob said, like, this is it. Some people are just like, this is boring, and I'm like, I cannot abide that because I feel like everything about this movie is clearly built with purpose. And I feel like it's absolutely trying to lull you into feeling like everything's going to be okay. You know, like Max, you know, like Max loses his friend and he's really upset and he tries to quit his job. And they're like, you'll be back. You'll be back. Don't worry about it. And then you have the sequence where like, yeah, he and his family are just hanging out. They're going for a drive. They're having some ice cream. She's hanging out by the beach. She's looking incredibly good. And she's, you know, she's loving it. And then it's like, but the menace is always there. The menace comes, the menace goes. She gets in trouble, she gets out of trouble. And then she's just gone, and the kid is just gone. And then Max is like, oh, damn. And then you have that ending where it's like, there's some satisfaction because, like, yeah, he kills these people, and the people absolutely, you know, probably should be dead because they were bastards. But it's also like, there's no joy. There's no, like, fist pumping, like, oh, hell yeah, he got that dude. It's just kind of like, well, shit, they're dead now. What happens to him? Like, even, you know, and again, we could talk about Mel Gibson as a person if we want. I don't really want to. But his performance in this movie, I think, is pretty good because he's just kind of like, he's just done. Especially at the end of the movie, he's just sort of, he's so done. He's like, ugh.
You buy the transition from, as Stuart said, Miffed Max to Mad Max. And no, I mean, he's a great performer across the board. It's sad that he chose to walk certain paths in life that we don't need to dwell upon here. You can look it up yourself, folks. I think it's well publicized by now.
Pretty bad.
Yeah, yeah. Not a great guy in many respects. But yeah, he's great in these. And I feel like there's a bit of subversion of the 70s revenge film that really plays out in Furiosa, I think, that shows how, revenge is empty. It will get you nothing. The crowd is still happy to see the explosion at the end, but it means nothing to Max. He's already lost so much, and the loss will continue to haunt him. And it should be pointed out, though, that final scene did inspire the Saw franchise. That singular idea is what spawned a, I don't know, 10-film franchise. So you can either blame or credit Mad Max.
Each one greater than the last.
Yes. Diminishing returns. What about increasing returns? Let's try that. And we have to move on. I do want to point out, this was apparently redubbed for an American release. I've never seen that version.
Yeah, don't watch it.
It sounds bad. They overwrite a lot of the fun Australian slang that I have to look up, honestly, and it teaches me things like sprog. And apparently not until a limited 2000 theatrical release did we actually hear the Australian dub in America. And then the DVD release restored in full. And this also shocked me that until the Blair Witch Project, this was the most profitable movie of all time. The first Mad Max.
Yeah, something like $400,000 Australian budget. And then it made back like what? Over 100 million.
Yeah, over 100 million. So Blair Witch, I think, was maybe like under 100K. And then that movie went crazy. So that is the first Mad Max. Let's talk about the sequel, The Road Warrior, which came out in 1981. This is where it all begins. This is where the most iconic Mad Max stuff comes from. This and Beyond Thunderdome. It's what everything has been referencing up until Fury Road. So the American release dropped the Mad Max 2 subtitle. And it was just known as The Road Warrior. And yeah, Max, his family is dead. He's a wandering mercenary. Time has advanced forward a little more. A lot of bad things have happened that are just briefly implied in the intro. But he's survived it all. And he is the kind of tarnished heart of gold guy where he's out for survival. And seldomly things will move him enough to act in non-selfish ways. And that's when we can get behind him.
Yeah, I do think one of the strong points about this film series in general is the fact that Most of the movies, I know it's kind of weird, there's only five movies, say most of them, but most of the five movies work entirely on their own. Like, even if there is a story going on, even if you can look at things that connect to each other and there is, you know, there's subtle things over time, almost all these movies just totally work on their own merits and you just tune in and watch them. Like, if you watch Fury Road today and you have no idea what these movies are about, that movie, like, in the breadth of it, it will tell you everything you need to know. Road Warrior, the same thing. Like, I think the American people were right to drop the two. And, like, just watch this. It doesn't matter if you know who Max is already. You don't need to know that Max already had a whole movie with his family in it. Like, just watch this movie, and it's incredible. You know, I think probably it's one of the weird things about the most recent one, Furiosa, the fact that it is very much couched in, oh, remember that character that we saw a few years ago? Here she is again. And if you watch this movie, you'll see lots of characters that you already know, and it's like, I think that's what kind of puts me off on it. I think it's still a great movie, but also it's kind of like, why are we suddenly putting the brakes on this, you know, free-willing franchise and making sure, oh, don't worry, you're going to find out everything you need to know about the last movie. Like, I just want to see a new movie. I don't know. And I feel like this movie, especially The Road Warrior, is a great example of that, because, like, it absolutely is a sequel. In most countries, it was released as a sequel. Certainly here in Japan, it's still called Mad Max 2. But if you don't know it's called Mad Max 2, if you don't know who Mad Max is, and you tune in, you get everything. You just see, oh, well, the world has collapsed. People are still alive. They're roaming around. They need water. They need gas. And they will kill each other to get it. That's it.
Yeah, I think this is the only one, until obviously Furiosa, that even has any footage from one of the previous movies in it. I think there's a very brief sort of shot of the family in this movie, just as a... We don't even need to know it's from another movie. You know, it's just like, this is what happened to him. And it's sort of the first one that really leans into the kind of storytelling aspect of, this is the story of this guy, you know. And it's like almost like a fable that's being kind of passed down sort of through time. And that's a motif that sort of sticks around until you reach Furiosa, where George Miller goes absolutely hog wild on the whole nature of storytelling sort of thing. But this one is... for me personally, just to kind of keep it, you know, breezy, I think it's a great, I think it's kind of a, I don't want to say shit sandwich, that's a bit too harsh, but the beginning I love, the end I love, and the middle I think kind of weighs it down a bit, goes on a bit too long, not enough happening. It's not my favorite. I like it better than 3. I do have a good time with it. There's a lot of great ideas, and there is an absolutely outstanding action sequence for the finale with some incredible stuff that still makes me wonder how they did it, you know, with like the flying guys and such. It's crazy to see it. I didn't expect it at all from an 81 movie, something that close to Fury Road, you know. I had a good time with it. I just don't think it's as tight as the first one. I don't think it's as focused as the first one. But it is still hugely enjoyable. And I think for many people, this is their favorite. So that's just my opinion, you know.
Yeah, I mean, even though I don't like Thunderdome more than this, I feel like Miller learned a bit from each production, where the Wasteland portion of Thunderdome is so tight. It's like the tight, condensed version of what was in Mad Max 2. Then it goes off in another direction we can talk about. But I feel like, oh, he learned how to tighten things up. In this movie, like I said, though, it's where all the iconic stuff comes from. It's Australia is a desert wasteland. Gasoline is now called guzzoline. Like, people are losing language because we're just so torn apart and you know, pushed down by this post-apocalypse world. Everyone is wearing, you know, wild clothing and S&M gear. People are basically, like, deciding, well, I'm a cartoon character now. And, I mean, I don't think we're on the brink of apocalypse right here, but I'm seeing a lot of that, like, on social media. It's like, I am here. I am now a cartoon, everyone. No, I'm not, like, here's my cartoon avatar. I'm not a VTuber, but just like, oh, I can have this wild persona because nothing matters, and so here's what I'm, how I'm coping with it. So I'm now Lord Humongous, and check out my cool tweets.
Yeah, I feel like, oh God, I forgot to look it up. I think it's Vernon Miller, the guy who would later on, he would later on show up in Commando and Inner Space. He'd do some Hollywood work, but like, not Humongous, but the guy under Humongous who's got like the mohawk and the shoulder pads that just have feathers on them. I feel like his outfit alone created, I think, like, I want to say like 55% of anime from the 80s. Like,
yes.
That one look. And video games too, of course. Like, what is two crude dudes, you know, crude buster, but a double dragon starring two Vernon Millers, you know? Like, what is it? That's what it is.
And ultimately, the Road Warriors as well, obviously.
Of course. Yeah,
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, pro wrestling, well, of course. Eventually... How much pro wrestling is drawn from, you know, either specifically or just sort of tangentially from these movies? It's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, the entire podcast could just be us reading a list of things this movie inspired, visually, thematically.
Yeah.
I just know when I saw Lord Humongous in this film, I know what Lord Humongous is, but then I thought, oh, hey, look, it's the blacksmith from Dragon Quest. It's just, this is what he looks like. He's an S&M guy, a big, burly S&M guy. And then we just had our Toriyama podcast not too long ago, and I'm thinking, man, Toriyama must have loved this movie, because I'm watching the anime adaptation of Sandland, one of his very late manga series, and Sandland is just Mad Max. It's just whimsical Mad Max with demons. And I thought, God, this hit Japan so hard, maybe even harder than it did in the West.
Yeah. Also, before Emma corrects me, I'm sorry. Vernon Wells is the actor's name. Vernon Wells. My apologies.
And yeah, I mean, it's hard to underline the impact of this, because I can think of, you know, modern games like Fallout that draw upon Mad Max throughout the entire series. And I did want to point out, though, this struck me as I was taking notes. And this is a movie I saw a few times before I saw any Mad Max movies. A very obscure movie called A Boy and His Dog, based on a Harlan Ellison short story. It is the much uglier version of Mad Max. It's the much more 70s version of Mad Max, where the main character is essentially a rapist. It's like depicting the wasteland in a much uglier, non-cartoonish way, where the author wants to explore, like, what are the ugliest things people will be doing in this post-apocalypse?
Yeah.
It also has an underground society of, like, people living idealistic lifestyle with scary clown robot mimes, too. So that's part of it as well. But A Boy and His Dog, so I think even Miller said that inspired me as well. But so much of that movie, I feel, inspired Mad Max. And it's a rough watch. There's some ugly stuff in that movie, but I love just how weird it is. And a lot of that movie went into the Fallout games as well.
Yeah, and it's got an ending that'll make you want to go and lie down in a dark room.
Yes. We should point out, it's Don Johnson, who would go on to be in Miami Vice and other things, and his talking dog. Well, he talks telepathically, so that's most of the movie.
It's worth a watch, but, you know, buckle up.
Yeah. It's like the idea of one thing that Mad Max doesn't do that Fallout does is the vaults in Fallout. That comes from A Boy and His Dog. And it's that the most fun, goofy, freaky stuff in A Boy and His Dog comes from that. But that I did want to point out. Miller said that definitely influenced Road Warrior Mad Max 2. And I'm thinking about it, I can definitely see how it was a big, it was standing in the shadow of A Boy and His Dog, a much lesser movie that's not nearly as good. Yeah, but that is Mad Max 2. We're going to sail on over to Mad Max 3, Beyond Thunderdome. 85 on this one. And I get the feeling, based on Letterboxd reviews, like you said, Diamond, we're on Letterboxd too much, but Letterboxd reviews and podcasts, it feels like a lot of people who weren't me saw this one on TV because it is the sole non-R-rated Mad Max movie, making it very easy to edit and put on broadcast television.
I mean, it's the most Hollywood of the first three movies for sure, you know, and I'm sorry, compared to the first one, which as we talked about was kind of, you know, A, rough around the edges, and B, very Australian to the point that they even redubbed it for the US. Then you have Road Warrior, which is very intense, like it's definitely not for kids, you know, like a lot of stuff goes down, like in the first few minutes, like no, kids should not be watching this. And then you have this movie, which is, you know, obviously big production, big values, you've got stars now, like Tina, I mean, Matt, you know, obviously Mel Gibson by this point is getting famous, not like super famous yet, but he's already a known idea at this point. Peekskill's own Mel Gibson, by the way, don't forget, he's from Peekskill, New York. Tina Turner, huge star in the movie. So I feel like this one had a lot of push to it, and then that also got it on cable a lot more. So yeah, like when I said like, growing up with like, this is the kind of movie that would just be on the background. I'm like, oh yeah, it's that Mad Max movie. I don't know what that's about. I don't know. So yeah, a lot of things contributed to that.
Arguably, this is the first Mad Max movie with a true movie star, a true superstar at its helm, and that is Tina Turner. I was looking at what Mel Gibson was doing internationally before this, and he was breaking out, but his true breakout role was Lethal Weapon in 87. Yeah. That's when he becomes a sex symbol. That's when he pretends that he's not Australian anymore. He's doing a lot of movies with American accents. And hell, as a kid, I was fooled. People would tell me he's Australian. I didn't believe them. But yeah, Tina Turner is the draw in this film as the rise of Mel Gibson is happening. And so, yeah, they're going for a broader appeal. They're going for, a bigger audience because of the PG-13 rating. And it does get very Spielberg-y in its back half. I couldn't put my finger on what was going on with this movie. And then I go into Letterboxd. I listen to the Blank Check episode. Everyone is like, Amblin, Amblin, Amblin. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is basically some chunk of this feels like a Spielbergian attempt to make a Mad Max film.
Well, I mean, at this point, this is 85. So this is post Twilight Zone, which means he's already met and worked with Spielberg to a degree. You know,
yes.
Miller has also like everyone involved, I would say, has been sort of touched by the Hollywood machine, if you will, either directly or indirectly. But yeah, Miller's, you know, done some work for hire, and you know, he's clearly had some collaboration with Spielberg already. Mel Gibson's branching out. You've got this star presence on set. The budget is a lot higher. So it's one of the fun things about this movie. It's like this movie overall, it's a success. If you look it up, like this, the early Mad Max movies in the U.S., each one outgrosses the last one. It's a trend that goes up. But if you look at Australia, like the first two Mad Max movies are successes, and this one's kind of a downer, which is kind of dramatic given that you can look at this movie, you can tell how much more it cost. It's like, this is clearly very expensive.
Oh, yeah, it's money in the life of the screen. Yeah. Sure.
And yet, you know, I don't think it made quite the impression anyone hoped for, which is probably one of the reasons why it took about 30 years to get another Mad Max movie, because everyone's like, oh yeah, people are tired of that movie. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was a time in which a movie could just have three entries and be done. I mean, this is at the time when Star Trek and Rocky were pushing beyond that, but it wasn't too crazy for a movie to end with three. In fact, it was pretty rare for a series to make it even that far. Oh, Stuart.
I think this one is a bit flabby again. I think the first act, as has been mentioned, is easily the most interesting. I mean, the money is all over the screen. The sets are absolutely astonishing. Like, it looks flawless. You've got it, and then it just gets really kind of silly and kiddy after that, especially once, you know, the kids show up. I mean, I think it's kind of
literal children.
That,
yeah.
I think it's kind of wild that, like, George Miller would work on Twilight Zone the movie and then go, I'm going to work with loads of kids next. But then again, maybe that's why he did it, or, you know, because that, you know, that must have been one hell of a jarring experience for him, not to mention for everyone. So I think a lot of what kind of makes Mad Max Mad Max isn't really here. It feels like it's leaning into a sort of kid friendlier direction. There's a lot of stuff I enjoy, but it's just overall kind of, I found myself kind of thinking like, when is this going to end? I'm tired of these children.
Yeah, I feel like it was a big bait and switch for me because I went into the movie thinking, I know what the reputation is. I know this was disappointing. And then the first act, I'm like, oh boy, I'm rubbing my hands together. There's this cool new settlement he's at. He's fighting in the Thunderdome. He's working in the pig poop factory. And there's great characters like Auntie Entity and Master Blaster and things like that. And then he ends up in like Goofy Town with the Lost Boys, and the movie kills a lot of time. And then the finale feels like a retread of things we saw in Mad Max 2, but with a train. And then we have basically a Mad Max equivalent of a pie fight where enemies are getting conked on the head with pots and pans and things like that. It's very silly.
Yeah, I would say of all the Mad Max movies that I've seen, and pretty much all of them to me have been recent-ish viewings. Like, this is the one that I remember the least about, and I'm the least interested in revisiting it. I will, I promise. But it's kind of, it's funny how all the movies, like, really hit me hard, and this one's kind of like, huh, okay. I mean, it's not bad, but it's also kind of like, it just kind of went through me, like pig poop, if you will.
I think the real reason why this movie is so weird and uneven and totally strange is that Byron Kennedy died in a helicopter crash in 1983. That was Miller's filmmaking partner. They were super close. I'm sure they saw like a lifetime of making films together. But he dies in a helicopter crash. Retronauts, warning, do not get into a helicopter ever. This is words of advice from Bob Mackie. Yeah.
I was going to say that's from I was thinking about Robert Evans, the other the podcaster who talks about not being in helicopters. Absolutely.
Yes.
Do not get in a helicopter.
I'm going to co-opt his advice. It's never a good idea. I don't care how much faster it'll get you there. Stay out of a helicopter. So he passes away. And according to George Miller, during the making of this film, he is in mourning to the point where he doesn't remember a lot of the making of the movie.
Mm.
So that's why he gets a guy named George Ogilvy to help him direct. He worked with George on some TV projects. One was called The Dismissal, which was about the 1975 Australian constitutional crisis. So this is the only Mad Max movie with a co-director because George Miller was in a really bad place, and that could explain why the movie is so off at times.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot to enjoy there, you know, more than I'd say a lot of sort of more contemporary movies. But I think my absolute favorite thing, sort of in terms of trivia, if I may, about Beyond Thunderdome is that Angelo Rossito, who played Master, the little person riding around on Blaster, he was in Todd Browning's Freaks back in 1932.
Wow.
Yeah, he's been there pretty much the entirety of Hollywood, and he's great, you know?
Yeah, he's delightful, and I was looking him up, Stuart, and apparently he was born in 1909 or something, so he was pretty old. And I love the relationship between Master and Blaster. It's so loving. And I love later where you think, you know, Master, he likes living in the pig shit factory and dressing the way he does. But no, he cleans up really nicely when he's in the train at the end. He looks very dapper.
You know, we said that a lot many times, but we should also just point out that obviously this movie gives us the NES game Blaster Master. That's just clear where the title came from.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
No question.
To the point where Master Blaster sounds wrong, because I grew up hearing Blaster Master spoken by every child for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. And then when I hear, oh, Master Blaster? Okay. Yeah, there's no way that title didn't come from this movie.
Master Blaster comes from the Stevie Wonder song Master Blaster from 1980.
Wow, so he was singing about a little guy riding on the back of a big guy?
Yeah, hang on, let me just check the lyrics. They want us to join their fighting, but our answer today is let all our worries, let the breeze throw our fingers slip away. Peace has come to Zimbabwe. Yeah, it's pretty much exactly the same.
Yeah, I can see it's just him telling the story of Thunderdome. I hope he's sued later.
Wait, now I'm sad because Stevie Wonder has never seen a Mad Max movie.
Mm.
Oh.
Well, they do have versions for the blind, where I'm sure a very colorful Australian man will say, now he's getting in his car. I don't think I'll do that again during this podcast, so don't worry.
There's really no need. He's done quite enough.
But it's so fun.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm in a safe place where I can do the Australian accent. This movie,
Don't worry, Bob. We will accept the brunt of the complaints on the monthly community show.
Canceled for doing Australian face on Retronauts. This movie, though, despite how disappointing it is, so much iconic stuff is from this one, including Thunderdome. Not just the iconic, can't we get beyond Thunderdome, sketch from Mystery Science Theater. The idea of the Thunderdome, the whole two men enter, one man leaves kind of thing. just became a part of the pop culture reference pile.
The word alone, Thunderdome has been parodied so many times. I mean, I'm thinking now, I don't even remember what episode it is, but I know The Simpsons did Beyond Blunderdome, and like, I forget what episode it is.
That was the episode where Mel Gibson turns up and drives up on his bottom. Yeah. Honestly, it's a pretty funny episode, but I was thinking of the Rick and Morty episode, which is just Beyond Thunderdome, to be honest.
I don't know if I've seen that one. Is that an earlier season?
I think it's like season three. It's Rick and Morty, so you take it or you leave it.
It can be funny. So yeah, that is Beyond Thunderdome. I want to move on now to Fury Road from 2015. So at this point, Mad Max is 30 years in the rearview mirror for George Miller. And by the 2010s, he's obviously known for kids' movies like Happy Feet and the Babe films. These are movies that couldn't be more different than Mad Max if they tried, although there is an edge to the movies. In fact, I was reading a lot of reviews of the film Babe last night, and a lot of people are saying it's kind of in jest, but oh, Babe is sort of like a Mad Max movie where this pig is in a world that he doesn't know, and it's all about survival. And I'm like, I can kind of follow you there. He's not making like a cutesy poo kitty schmitty movie that is very stupid. He is putting heart into this, putting a lot of very Australian sentiments into this as well. So it's not like he's phoning it in with these kids' films. And I hear Happy Feet is very twisted.
But if you haven't seen it, Babe, Pig in the City is kind of fucked. You know, seriously, there's some insane visuals and some genuinely quite upsetting stuff in it. And I think I had trouble even getting the rating it wanted for that reason. But I seriously recommend checking it out because it's really worth it.
Yeah, that's next on my agenda, Diamond.
If we're highlighting stuff that George Miller did in between Thunderdome and Fury Road, I also want to point out The Witches of Eastwick is a really intense, like wild out there movie about women. Three women who get together and they maybe start dating the devil and then things get like really crazy. That's a movie that I'm pretty sure did well. Like it was another one that I heard about for years before I actually saw it when I grew up a little older. But that's one I think that it's left out of a lot of the George Miller retrospectives because it's absolutely worth watching.
Yeah, it's great.
Jack Nicholson so as the happens. Devil. Good casting. Yeah.
I caught like a bit of it when I was a little kid just on TV and it scared the shit out of me, to be honest.
Not for kids. Another one, not for kids. Yes.
So unlike what I thought about this movie, not knowing anything about it, it's not a desperate reboot. This is something that Miller wanted to make since the late 80s. And the film actually entered pre-production in the year 2000 with Gibson set to star because he was still of Mad Max age, potentially. And I don't know if this has been confirmed, but Sigourney Weaver, they had her in mind for Furiosa. She would have been closer to 50, but potentially still could have been a good Furiosa. She was an alien resurrection in like 1998, so she was still in action movies at that point.
Sure. Still in shape, still looking great. Why not?
But then a lot of things happened, including 9/11, that pushed production down the hill. And a lot of things happened, like Mel Gibson melting down and getting canceled like 15 times. So many delays. George Miller has got to make Happy Feet because he had some agreements in place. And so he's making a few Happy Feet movies. And, you know, recounting the nightmare of making this film is its own podcast or perhaps podcast series. I've got the book on my library hold list. I think it's called Blood, Sweat, and Chrome. It's about the making of Fury Road.
Yeah,
and it goes into a lot of the details.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to reading that. I suggest our listeners check that one out as well. But despite how long it took for this movie to come into being, this movie, the source of it is Miller's idea, what if a movie was just one long car chase? And you can see how Mad Max 2 is kind of grasping at that, but can't quite get to it because out of necessity, there's got to be a few narrative pit stops to explain things. This, to me, and I'm sure it's not presumptuous to say this, it feels like a new kind of action movie. I dare say it is.
Yeah, definitely.
Where I would not have the fortitude to sit through a 2-hour action movie that kept moving, but Miller is so masterful, and no action movie has this level of momentum. Even great ones like, I don't know, Terminator 2, that has some of the most classic set pieces in all of cinema, but there is still, you know, very entertaining still, but there's still downtime to tell the story. I'm talking for a very long time. Stuart, please jump in.
No, I was just going to say, Terminator 2, there's just a dumb little kid ruining it. And there's no kids in this movie. This is the lesson to learn from Beyond Thunderdome. No children ever.
Hey, Mad Max 2 had the feral child, and he didn't ruin things. In fact, he went on to become a very good narrator.
Oh, he was okay, yeah.
Yeah.
But he was feral. No, Fury Road, Fury Road is just, like, the most singular sort of experience. And even Furiosa is nothing like Fury Road at all. By design, by choice, it can't top it, so it doesn't really try. And Fury Road, non-stop chase, a little breather, not very long, and even that breather is kind of devastating, and then it's back to the chasing. And I feel, for me, what makes it work is, even if you just get to a point where you're just kind of like, okay, I get it, truck, big truck, you know, something crazy is going to come into frame and make you go, what the hell is that? And the movie is not going to tell you what it is. You just got to roll with it. You're just like, okay, which is what makes it so compelling. Is the, I don't like using this word, but it makes you think about, like, what's the lore here? You know, what's this guy's deal? The Mad Max Furiosa obviously delves into that a lot more, as well as the art book for Mad Max Fury Road. But you don't need to know any of it. It's all just this breathless adrenaline rush that just completely works, despite having characters that are, I don't want to call them sketches, but they're almost just kind of like singular things. I don't know how to describe it. They're just bare, like Mad Max himself. Max himself in this movie, but he barely even needs to be there. It's not his movie anymore.
That's I think probably the biggest surprise, and I'm sure I remember on the internet at the time it was still very, a lot of people, you know, the garbage people of the world are like, oh, it's feminist, they made it woke, and it's like, no, it's just, it's, he's in the movie, but it's not about him. He quickly realizes how much, like, he's just there, and he's gonna leave, and it's literally, the movie ends with him walking away. It's like, yeah, I'm done here, and you know, he does his part, he plays his role. And then he walks away, and the movie itself is about other people. I mean, you look at the cast top to bottom, just totally stacked. I mean, in case you didn't know, Hugh Kearney Bynes, I can never remember his name, but the actor who plays the toe cutter in the very first Mad Max is here as Immortan Joe, and he's wearing this ridiculous makeup, and he's got this giant mask on. And he is terrifying, but he's all, like, even though he's like clearly old and decrepit and about to die, he's still terrifying. He's like Darth Vader without any powers, but he's still like intimidating as hell. You got Nicholas Holt, who's the war boy who we're hearing, Nux, I think, and like he's almost the only one who has like a real arc in the movie, and it's really impressive. And he gives a great performance. Before, I think a lot of people knew who he was. I did not recognize him in most of their movies. I had to go back and realize, oh wait, that's Nicholas Holt in that movie with a shaved head, and talking about his buddies who are basically, you know, tumors on his shoulder. Like, it's I mean, really, really, we could talk about this movie for like 5 hours.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
so incredible. And it's just, it's packed. And especially this, you know, watching Furiosa this week, watching Mad Max yesterday, as I did, I can see so many things that are connected to all these things that I really impressed me. I mean, in the very first movie, in the very first chase scene, the Knight Rider is there, and he's screaming into the car radio. It's like, you know, I am the Knight Rider, and everyone's like, you know, remember the Knight Rider and see the Knight Rider, remember him. And it's like, the backbone of the sort of the cult in Fury Road is about, you know, witness me, and like, I'm gonna go to Valhalla. Like, they've got this, you almost see like a religion is built up in this world. You know, in a place where society is gone, it's like the only thing that matters is, you know, being acknowledged by everyone around you, and then, you know, remembering you as best they can, and telling people about yourself once you're gone. Like, that's it. That's all there is.
Yeah, that's like the importance of storytelling in this world is underlined by how much these characters will die just to have a story about them be told later in the future of this world. Yeah, it's incredible when you can. I love always encountering, oh, they made a new kind of movie. Oh, they made a new kind of video game. I'm excited to experience it. And that's what I was feeling when I was watching this movie for the first time, not knowing anything about it and thinking, oh, this action scene probably is going to end soon. And then thinking, oh, maybe this is just the whole movie, and then realizing, this is the whole movie. And I try not to be a movie guide, I think, because other movie guys annoy me. I've seen a lot of movies. I haven't seen a lot of it, some of the more important movies. Like, I've never seen The Godfather. And if I say that in front of someone, they'll go, you've never seen. And then there's an argument, there's a conversation. I only get like that with this film, and thankfully only internally. And in fact, when I was scouting for Retronauts co-host to be on this episode, I said, oh, hey, I'm doing a Mad Max episode. Who wants to be on it? And one of our lovely co-hosts said, oh, I've never seen that. Not even Fury Road. In my head, I thought, you've never. And then I kind of wanted to mail them a Blu-ray or something just because it's a singular, amazing experience. And I just want everyone to have it because I was once like them. I thought, a desperate Mad Max reboot. It's not like a Ghostbusters or Beetlejuice reboot. This thing deserves to exist.
Yeah, I hear you. My kids, I think, are still a little too young to enjoy any of these movies, but even especially Fury Road. But my wife loves to go to the movies, and I've been trying now for almost a decade to get her to watch Fury Road, and I can't get her to do it. I don't know what it is. I need a Japanese celebrity to come along. She needs to meet Hideo Kojima in real life, and then if he tells her how good it is, then maybe she'll watch it. I don't know. I'm stumped.
I have seen The Godfather. I don't know if that makes me a movie guy. I don't know if I want to be a movie guy. I do like movies, though. I am a guy.
So you can like movies and be a guy, but you don't want to be a movie guy.
Okay. I'll try and navigate this. It seems fraught. But thank you.
And one thing I do want to point out about this movie is that we mentioned how the Mad Max series largely avoids the topic of sexual violence, especially against women in this world. And I feel like it was inevitable that one of the movies handled this topic. And I think this handles it in a very classy and subtle way where we don't have to see anything that's happening. It's all implied. But, here's an avenue that was not explored. And the success, it feels more rewarding because you understand how dire things are for this group of people now.
Yeah, I mean, the scene where the wives cut off their chastity belts really just, I think one of them even kicks the chastity belt if they cut it off, which is like so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Although, as long as we're singing the praises of George Miller, we also need to highlight Margaret Sixel, who in fact is Mrs. George Miller. She is the editor of this movie. She spent about 2 years of her life putting all this stuff together. If you look it up, they gave her some kind of unimaginable number of feet of film that they shot, like so many hours and hours and hours of footage that she had to work with, and she cut it all down into this movie, and she very rightly got an Academy Award for her work. So if we talk about how incredible this movie is and how it feels so unlike anything else, credit to her. Which, by the way, Bob, she's from South Africa, so all your earlier accent work was on brand.
Okay, good. I was actually doing my Margaret Sixel impression. I only dusted off at parties. We could talk a tiny bit about Furiosa. Unfortunately, not a lot of people have seen it. I imagine a lot of listeners haven't seen it. They might be waiting for, the home release or the streaming release. But I feel like it's hard to come up with an original take on the movie because I feel like everyone has the same take, and that take is correct in that it's not as good as Fury Road because nothing can be. Unfortunately, it reminds you too much of Fury Road out of necessity based on what it is. And then the movie ends with clips of Fury Road. So I feel like it cannot possibly succeed in the way Fury Road does. But at the same time, you are watching a George Miller movie and the craft is there and there's nothing else like it. So in a vacuum, excellent film. Unfortunately, it is too close to the life-changing cinematic experience that it is being spun off from.
I want to know who came down to like, hey, we need to end this movie with clips of the last movie, because I feel like that sucks the energy right out of the theater. Like, I enjoyed this movie. I watched it. I absolutely, like, it's a very intense movie. It's not on Fury Road's level, but it delivers. It keeps you engaged. It's long, but it doesn't feel long. I was not looking at my watch. But then it ends with just, it does like the Rogue One thing where it goes right up to the end, right up to the start of Fury Road. And then you just see literal clips of Fury Road during the credits. And I'm just like, man, don't remind me of how much better Fury Road is. I'm sorry. I this is a great movie and I recommend it, but holy shit, don't do that. That's stupid. Oh.
I'm at very real risk of being a film guy, so I'm going to be very brief on this one. I mean, I think this was a film, and I'm so sorry for what I'm about to say. It's so pretentious, I know. I feel like this is a film, ultimately, that is about the sort of severe patriarchal oppression of storytelling in Hollywood, women's stories, because it is, for me, from like the first, I'm not going to spoil it, but one of the first shots is one of what they call the history man. And he's looking at the camera and then he fades away. And I'm just like, oh, that's interesting. What the hell is that all about? And as I watched the film, I started to feel like, oh, I see. This is even more about myth making than any of the other movies. It's almost like a thesis on George Miller's entire sort of career of movies. I think it's a really feminist one here, even more so than Fury Road. So the Chuds can get really mad about it. And as a big old film studies nerd, I loved it. I thought it was thematically really, really impressive, and I want to watch it again. But if you are here for more Fury Road, it is very pointedly not that. And there are, in that respect, it doesn't deliver the same experience. And Fury Road is, the way I see it, Fury Road is just the most perfect like 5-star action film, and this for me is like a perfect 5-star maybe final movie. Here's what I want to tell you. I'm not going to spoil it because I could go on and on and on about all the stuff that I loved in this film, but for me, yeah, I think it's kind of a masterpiece. I absolutely adored it.
Yeah, I think we are all Mad Max likers and can say please go watch the film. It's a very good film, even if, again, can't compete with Fury Road. It reminds me of something I like to paraphrase a lot. The writer of Catch-22, Joseph Heller, he says, people ask me why haven't I written a book that good. He says, no one else has. So that's essentially what George Miller can say. Why didn't you make a movie better than Fury Road? Well, nobody else has, so why can I? Why should I?
But just before we move on, I just want to say, because I saw Furiosa this week, and then I watched Mad Max, the first one, again. I was impressed watching Mad Max to see little things that were definitely, you know, thematically on point, and how much felt, you know, like a kinship. I really enjoyed how Furiosa still, you know, I think every movie does this, but even the fact that Furiosa in 2024 is still doing like the hand crank stuff, where it's like the movie's like, what do you call it? Like, it's like undercranked, where like the action kind of feels like it's kind of sped up a little bit. It almost looks like slapstick at points, even though that's not jovial.
Don't forget the George Miller special, zoom in on the eye very, very slowly.
Yeah.
That's in
yeah.
Movies.
Oh, no, I definitely noticed the undercranking, and I noticed it's a common theme throughout all of the movies. And then when you first see it, you're thinking, is this going to be too silly? But then you get wrapped up in how fast everything is moving.
So as enjoying Furiosa as I did, I also feel like it also made me appreciate Mad Max even more watching it again. Because like, oh, this is just... You know, he got so much right when he was still figuring out how to even do this, that even years later, he's still doing some of the same tricks and it still works. But he had a lot of this down, you know, 45 years ago, and this movie still holds up to me. So I feel like I appreciate both movies more, having seen them back to back. And I will definitely see Furiosa again, just maybe not this week. And I'm sure I'm going to have more affection for it the next time around. I'm sure I'll pick up on little things. But yeah, it is kind of hard to watch that movie and come out of it, you know, because of the way they end it, just kind of like, oh man, Fury Road was so good. So good, you guys.
Yeah, I hope that was a studio note and not a Miller idea to include clips of Fury Road at the end. Unnecessary.
Oh no, you know what? No, forget it. You know what? I love the clips. I think they fit in with everything in the movie about how it's all about telling a story and passing it down, ending it with clips of like, oh, because they've thrown that out about whether or not any of this happened the way that they said it did, with the history men who are telling this as men, and maybe they're enhancing and exaggerating this what they did. It's a lot. I loved it.
I can at least respect the history men, because I think that is just a future podcaster, and
that's what we are.
When the world ends, I'll be one of these old men with a long beard and runes scraped all over my face,
talking about how Super Mario Brothers used to be called Doki Doki Panic.
Somebody's got to know in these settlements. So moving on to the games. Yes, there are only two Mad Max games and a handful of canceled ones, and we're not going to linger too long on these, but we'll talk about them just to cover them. The first one is Mad Max. It's developed by Grey Matter and published by Mindscape for the NES in 1990. And if you were to imagine a licensed Mad Max game from 1990, what they made is basically what you're imagining now. It's you searching through these non-linear maps for supplies. You go into traditional overhead scrolling action segments to get supplies, and then you have to use the supplies to buy tickets to get into an arena, where once you pass the arena, you move on to the next stage. And that's essentially it. And I'm not sure if you have any more knowledge about this, Stuart, because I found out that it's one of those weird things that happens in reverse sometimes, where they make the ripoff, and then the later version, they actually get the license. So this was originally a microcomputer game called Road Raider / Motor Massacre. Came out for many microcomputers. And then when they decided to make the NES version, they said, let's just get the license and sell it that way. And of course, there are some compromises to make the NES version, but it's basically the same game.
Yeah, I have not played the micro one. I didn't know that existed. I've seen the NES version, and I mean, it's got horrible music. It's got great sound effects. And honestly, it looks kind of fun for what it is. It's not the sort of thing I would rush to play now, but I think it could be a lot worse considering.
It's got a weird gameplay loop in that you're driving around and then you have a brief sequence where you have to like raid a place to get supplies. But then you get to the arena and the arena is just more driving. Like you're like, I don't want to get in like, you know, the realism of it all, but it's like, how big is the arena that you're able to drive a car around? Like, it must be like the size of Detroit. Like, it's this massive place with like giant pits in it, and the pits are opening and closing. And like, I feel like you have to ram like 20 something cars to their death in order to proceed to the next level. Like, it's a really strange setup. I feel like, given that it's called Mad Max, I feel like this game is very little about humanity, and it's more about just driving around, which is, I don't know. To me, it's a strange ratio of Max to Mad, if you will.
I do like how they keep the touch from the other version of the game, where when you shoot another human being, they kind of melt, like melt into pieces.
Yeah, it's surprisingly gross, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, bloodless but nasty.
there's not very much to say. Nobody remembers this game. Nobody talks about it. Again, the cover to me as a kid is like, Mad Max, this looks boring. Who's this guy and his dog? But yeah, it's just kind of the most obvious interpretation of this game or this movie for 1990 console design mindset. We're going to move on because 25 years later, there's another Mad Max game finally. Once again, called Mad Max, developed by Avalanche, published by Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment for the PS4, the Xbone, the PC, all the good ones. And this was planned for release before Fury Road, but it came out months after the movie. And unfortunately, it also came out on the same day as Metal Gear Solid 5, another open-worldy game in a desert-style environment, which super unfortunate for this game, which I feel is like a sterling 7 out of 10 classic.
I feel like this game really got handicapped by a lot of things that obviously couldn't have helped. They couldn't be helped. I'm sure like during development, they had a lot of issues with publishers, you know, whims. The fact that it's released after the movie, but in fact has almost nothing to do with the movie. You know, like there is no Furiosa in the movie. Like some of the characters are there and some of the places are there. But to me, like having seen the movie and loved the movie, everything I heard about the game made it sound like, oh, this isn't for me. This is like, this almost feels like a pushback against the movie. Like, oh, it's more Mad Max because the movie didn't have enough Mad Max in it. I'm like, well, that's not really interesting to me. And which is unfair because it sounds like it actually is a cool game that's worth investigating. But given the circumstances surrounding its release, and you know, other versions were planned but canceled, other publishers had their own ideas, and just, you know, there's probably a whole book in just getting this movie, like much like Fury Road had its own book, like there's probably a book behind this game, like what it took to get it out there, and then what happened and what went wrong, and how no one seemed to have any faith in it, including George Miller, who apparently kind of badmouthed it after the fact.
Yeah, he didn't.
Doesn't
like,
sound
yeah.
fair.
Yeah, Jason Schreier, get on that, please. Now, the thing that I found interesting after seeing Furiosa is how much of the game is in Furiosa, like all the way down. And I don't think this is really a spoiler. Like, for a very brief scene, you do actually see the character Chumbucket, who's with you for this entire game, pretty much. He's there. He's in Furiosa. And I was like, oh, it's that guy who annoyed me a lot. But I played this game. I think it's probably one of those not-for-me games because I kind of respect it. But because I like 100%ing everything, I get really obsessed about picking up all of the scrap and knocking everything over and 100%ing everywhere you can visit. And you can visit about a million places, and they're all quite similar. So I really highly recommend you don't try and 100% this game. And then you will probably have fun with it. It's really not worth your time to explore every little environment. And I don't think you're supposed to do that. So get in there and... yeah, it's fun. It's got nice emergent kind of gameplay, driving around in these wastelands, and suddenly like a convoy will turn up and you can be like, should I take that convoy down or should I ignore it and go where I'm supposed to be going? Yeah, I think it's pretty good. I think 7 out of 10 is a good score for it, really. It's and if you're a fan, maybe bump that up to 7.1, you know, generously.
Yeah, I was impressed, Stuart, when I played a few hours of this yesterday for the first time. I didn't have time. I was in the press in 2015 and also playing Metal Gear Solid 5 a lot. So I kind of shrugged at this game and thought, well, it can't match up to the Fury Road experience. But even if it is the most obvious open world version of Mad Max, it's made with a lot of care. And like you were saying, a lot of Furiosa elements are in this because George Miller wanted to film Furiosa back to back with Fury Road, and it just didn't pan out. So a lot of those ideas work their way into this game. Like, I believe it's either Scrotus or Rictus that makes their debut in the video game.
Scrotus,
and they're not in Fury Road.
Scrotus, yeah.
So yeah, if you played this game, when you saw Scrotus in Furiosa, you're probably clapping and hooting and saying, I know that guy, because
yeah,
he was in this game.
Yeah, Scrotus going crazy.
Yeah. I mean, this is made by Avalanche, who makes the Just Cause series. So you're right, Stuart. If you try to 100% any of those games, you will go insane. It's they're made to like take over your life.
It has that thing as well, which where you have to hold A to do things instead of just pressing it once, which makes me cross, and I wish they would stop doing it.
Yeah, I'm not used to holding down triggers. I mean, I think I did too much trigger holding down in Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, so I'm very tired of that. So I was getting a little fatigued by driving in the game, even though that's just the standard driving controls for every game. I think Final Fantasy VII Rebirth might have broken me in some way.
I think you can get this game now for like $5, and it's well worth that. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, grab it.
Because there's all of the storytelling is so visual in the Mad Max movies, I actually delight in reading bios on characters in this game because you never are given that much of a luxury in any of these movies. You have to learn just by watching what they're doing and how they're interacting with people. But it's nice to see, oh, here's 5 paragraphs on Scrotus. I think I'll sip some wine and read about Scrotus tonight. So, yeah, I mean, like you said, Stuart, it's $5 usually, and it's a moderately excellent multiplayer game, or sorry, open world game. That is a little compromised based on the publisher. There have been a lot of canceled Mad Max games, so let's talk about these. This one wasn't canceled, but it was reskinned. So there's a game called Outlander that came out in 1992 for the Genesis and Super Nintendo. And apparently they wanted this to be the sequel to the previous Mad Max game. They're both published by Mindscape, but the license expired and they either couldn't get the rights again or they didn't want to pay for it. So it comes out in this Outlander form. To me, it does not look very good. Actually, the NES game looks like it's more fun than this, but it's still very Mad Max-y.
Yeah, just real quick. I think that the visuals when you are driving are surprisingly impressive. Like, the frame rate is surprisingly good, and you've got enemies. Like, you can hit them with your car, you'll see them slam into your windshield. You've got a little window for when they drive past you, sort of to the left or right, and then you can put your shotgun out the window and just take them down. And there is something cool about that, but then you get to the side-scrolling sections, and it's, like, some of the worst shit that I've ever seen. It's like Rolling Thunder, but, like, somehow worse. Sorry for the Rolling Thunder fans.
Yeah, that part does not look good. I prefer the overhead Mad Max NES game action. But
just to fit in with the Aussie, I call it Rolling Chunder. There you go.
That's one of the Aussie slang things we haven't hit upon yet. So yeah, that's Outlander. Not a lot to say about that. The next item on our list, though, is fascinating to me. It is Mad Max Autorama, originally intended for Project Nemo, which was Hasbro's VHS-based video game system. That lived on in the form of productions that were made for it that never saw release on the original platform, like Night Trap and Sewer Shark. They were made for this system, eventually came out much, much later, which is why when you're playing Night Trap in 1992, it looks like it was made several years ago.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, starring Dana Plato, that's all you need to know. Starring Dana Plato.
In 87, that was a draw.
Yeah.
They were competing with Atmosphere. They couldn't possibly win.
It's true. I mean, and talk about pearls before swine. There's a lot written online about the making of this. Apparently, George Miller wanted on board with this project. He wanted to direct the footage, and he's like, I don't know what the rest of this game is, but I'll direct it. So that was what how his involvement was going to work, because he didn't understand how they would put it together in forms of an in the form of an interactive game movie, but he wanted to direct the footage. And at this point, Mel Gibson could have been in this Mad Max spinoff. From everything I've read, it seemed like he was on board as well. But apparently, they designed a lot of the game. Hasbro found out that Mad Max is not a kids franchise, and this was not the market they were going for. So they wanted this to be very compromised, and eventually they shut it down. So there's a lot online about this, but I can just imagine if George Miller had shot this and it never came out.
That is so wild to me, because like half of the 1980s was about R-rated movies getting games made for children, you know,
yeah.
Like all those, think about all those horror franchises that got NES games, you know,
yeah,
like
Nightmare
you weren't Street, yeah. Like kids weren't supposed to watch those movies, but they did. And they knew about them and they were famous. And they like the idea that you had a potential Mad Max game with Miller and Gibson in the 80s. And the company's like, oh, I don't know, this maybe this isn't for kids. Like it's not for kids, but they love it.
Yeah, I mean, on that note, it's weird that Mad Max was never marketed to me like RoboCop and Terminator, Aliens, Freddy Krueger, Jason, all that stuff was. There was no Mad Max action figures. And I'm sure maybe for the adult collector, they came out much later. But Miller was very careful about licensing the property.
A Mad Max cartoon could have been dope, honestly.
Could yeah, I was
really
gonna say,
cool.
It's kind of funny. There seems to be no real animated history. I know there's a comic book at some point, but I don't think there's any real animated history. Is there of Mad Max? I don't think so.
I can't think of anything, no.
Yeah, and I think the comic book was just a very limited Fury Road tie-in, and I'm hearing not great things about that comic book. Anyway,
yeah,
it's
also sort of been clearly decanonized now by Furious, so not that it really matters that much.
So yeah, that's Mad Max Autorama. What could have been? And then we have Mad Max Asylum, which was going to be an early aughts generation take on Mad Max. And given what we know about that generation, it might not have been that great, but it was going to be developed by Melbourne House, which was eventually absorbed by Chrome.
Oh, my God.
And apparently George Miller met with them and eventually shut them down. But there's a fun story about the meeting with him in which he came in to talk about the making of the game, and they dump like their big design doc in his lap because they're just so proud of all the ideas they came up with. He opens it up, and on the first page, there is a page that says, here's three white reasons why Beyond Thunderdome sucked. And
oh, wow.
They're really embarrassed because they forgot that's part of the design doc. And he's like, guys, I know what's wrong with the movie. Don't worry. But he eventually shoots that project down. So maybe that pissed him off. Maybe he didn't trust them.
If it was Chrome, they were probably just like, yeah, Mad Max runs around throwing boomerangs and collecting opals. And if you double jump, he uses the boomerangs to hover. It can't have been good. It can't have been.
Yes, I guess they're behind Ty the Tasmanian Tiger.
Yeah, that's the bit. Sorry, okay. That is the bit I'm doing there. Yeah,
I just wanted to make sure I was right. Yeah. There's another guy named Tack. Is it like a caveman?
Max
named
the
Tack?
Australian man.
Okay. I'll take your word for it. And then finally, we have competing Fury Road games that were going to be in development at the same time. So Corey Barlog, I forgot he briefly left Sony. And in that time, he was going to be working on a original Mad Max Fury Road game. That never came into being. And then Interplay was developing their own Fury Road game, but then Warner Brothers got the rights to publish the video game, and that changed. These are two things that never came into being. I'm not sure how far either one got into development, but Corey Barlog, at least, was a consultant on Mad Max, the eventual 2015 game.
Yeah, the Corey Barlog story goes back quite a few years, so it just helps to underline how much of the 21st century George Miller spent trying to get back into the Mad Max business, but he had to just jump through, you know, so many hurdles and get the right people and get so much stuff done. The fact that he had like multiple tie-in projects that just didn't come together at the right time. So there's this, you know, you've got about 20 years of history now of just, you know, George Miller says this and George Miller wants to do this, and like it just didn't happen. It's like we could have, you know, 60-year-old Miller could have made a Mad Max movie. Who knows what that would have been like? I don't know.
Yeah, from my research, it seemed like Miller is not a gamer per se, but he's aware of video games and what they should be. And above all, he is worried about any bad licensing tarnishing this brand, which I think is why Mad Max has remained so pure. It's hard to find like low-quality Mad Max products. It's basically, here are five movies, here are two video games, one you can't play anymore, so don't worry about it. And that's kind of it. There's no, this is not Star Wars. There's no like Mad Max series hitting Disney Plus every 18 months.
Yet.
Let's hope for the best. When these creators die, that sanctity is upheld. Things like Back to the Future and Mad Max. I hope to God they're not mine for all they're worth.
I guess in the case of Mad Max, though, what you also have is you have now, 40 years of people who love Mad Max and made their own thing. Because so much of what makes so much about Mad Max is basically, available to anyone. Like there's no desert copyright. You don't need to, you can put a guy in a fast car in the desert without paying George Miller. the fact that, it's like there are like at least three or four other properties that are basically Mad Max plus something else. Like I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't mention Fist of the North Star, because Fist of the North Star. Yeah. It's absolutely, Mad Max plus martial arts, and, Fist of the North Star does have, I think 30 games. I mean, we probably touched on 10 of them in the podcast. That was only a fraction of the total number of Fist of the North Star games that are out there, including the more recent one, which is basically Fist of the North Star / Mad Max / Yakuza that you can play on your PS4 right now, called Lost Paradise. And do I want to play Mad Max? I'm kind of curious. I feel like I didn't give enough time, but I know I didn't get enough time into Lost Paradise, so I definitely want to play that first.
Yeah, Mario Kart is basically Mad Max when you think about it.
Yeah, I don't see any people in that world. I just see cars and warriors. you know, Diamond, I was thinking, in my head I was thinking people can't flagrantly rip off existing properties that much anymore, but then I realized, Zack Snyder just made his own Star Wars and nobody cares?
Yeah, it's just out there on Netflix. You can watch it whenever you want. It's got all the elements. You got farmers, you got droids, you got an empire, you got a Darth Vader type guy. I didn't hate it, but it also, it's like the more I watch it, the more I'm like, this doesn't really seem great, Zach.
It seems like the option is there to not watch it at all, so I think I'm going to exercise that one.
Yeah, I really can't recommend it. I'm sorry.
Bring back the owls, that's what I say. Bring back the owls.
You're free to not watch it. The Owls of Ga'Hoole?
Yeah, the Owls of Ga'Hoole.
I forgot about that. I'm pro any animated bird movie. But we have to wrap up soon. My final question for all of you is, will Death Stranding 2 become a Mad Max game so gradually we won't even notice? Now, what I'm noticing online is Hideo Kojima is becoming BFFs with George Miller. Relationship with Guillermo del Toro ended. George Miller is my new best friend. It's that meme. And he's trying to get meetings with Anya Taylor-Joy, and I feel like we're going to see a lot more Mad Max-y stuff in Death Stranding 2, which I'm excited about. And then reflecting upon it, I'm thinking, wow, Death Stranding is kind of Mad Max-y, and I'm just seeing Kojima just tweeting, this is my fifth Furiosa screening, and look, I got the pamphlet, and he's so excited about the movie, and I'm happy for him.
Which, by the way, is extra impressive when you realize that, again, it wasn't that late, but Furiosa didn't open here in Japan until the end of May, so if he's seen it five times already, that means he's seen it multiple times per week since it come out. There's not a lot of downtime for Kojima between Furiosa screenings in his timeline.
Maybe,
also, didn't he get Miller to appear in one of his games? Am I crazy?
I don't think Miller was in Death Stranding. There was Del Toro and Conan O'Brien and Junji Ito. I'm not sure if Miller was in that, but maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe Miller was already hyped for two.
Could be.
Oh crap! It's hard to keep track. It's hard to keep track of the Kojima celebrities.
Apparently, he is in Death Stranding 2, yeah.
Oh, okay. Nice. Okay, there, so he will be in 2. I mean, I'm bringing this up as a joke, but George Miller has said on the record, I didn't like the 2015 game, but if I could have anyone make the game, it'd be Kojima. But I wouldn't ask him to do that. And I'm thinking, that's all you had to say.
Yeah, it's no longer on the beach. It's now in the desert, and it's in Australia, and it's not called Death Stranding 2. It's called Mad Max.
There will no longer be a Death Stranding 2. This is now going to be a Mad Max game. And Norman Reedus, go home. Tom Hardy, what are you doing? But yeah, let's see what happens in the future. I'm excited about Mad Max, even though Garfield was eating Mad Max's lunch, as he's known to do, and I'm worried about the future of the series, but also George Miller is in his 80s, and maybe he doesn't have another one of these in him, but he seems so spry. But I am just excited about Mad Max and excited to talk to two people as excited as me. But we're going to wrap up now. This has been an episode of Retronauts. And if you want to follow us online, we're on Twitter and Blue Sky as Retronauts. And this is all brought to you via the Retronauts Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts. And if you're interested in supporting the show and getting a lot of bonus episodes, I believe over 100 at this point, sign up at the $5 level. You'll get two bonus episodes every month. They're all full length. And you'll also get a weekly column and podcast by Diamond Flight, who you just heard on this podcast. And that really helps support the show. And we like to give you, I would say, at least 3 hours of audio content extra every month just for signing up. So please check it out at patreon.com/retronauts. I will do my own personal plugs last, but let's go over to Stuart. Where can we find you? What are you working on, and what do you want to promote?
Hello. You can find me, well, on Retronauts a lot of the time. I haven't actually done it yet as of this recording, but I'll be doing a weekly thing for the Patreon soon as well, so look forward to that. You can find me on Twitter as Chupacabra, and you can find me on Blue Sky as Stuart Chip. And I wrote a book called All Games Are Good, and it is a very good book, and I think you should read it, and that's the best pitch I've got.
And Diamond, how about you?
You can find me around the internet by looking for Fight Club, F-E-I-T, that is my last name, C-L-U-B, that's something a barbarian might wield in the wilds of Australia. Also, my website is fightclub.me, that's .me, so that's a good place to catch up on what I've been writing, what I've been podcasting about. All my social links are in there, too. And also, before we wrap up, I just want to make sure, am I the only driver on this podcast? Because I do have a car.
Oh, no, I drive.
You do? Okay, you have a drive. Okay.
I drive very dangerously.
Okay. Do you have any skulls or feathers on your ride?
Yes.
Excellent. I've got a family car, so I can't. Sorry.
And as for me, I have been Bob Mackey, the main host for this one. You can find me on Twitter and Blue Skies, Bob Servo. My other podcast is the Talking Simpsons Network. You can find those podcasts wherever you find podcasts. There's Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon. And if you sign up at the Patreon at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons, there's over 180 bonus episodes there covering things like Futurama and King of the Hill every month. But that has been it for another episode of Retronauts. We'll see you again next week. But until then, just walk away. Just walk away.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.